Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 25th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, we have John DeGraff. Today's session is entitled, Using Television to Promote Social Change. Live simply that others may simply live. Let's listen in.
We either saw today or have seen in the past the affluenza film itself.
Today.
Okay, pretty much everybody, okay. So I won't, I'm not gonna repeat any of that because I think you've seen it. And what I would like to do is to show both some clips from an earlier film which I made back in 1993 about what I think one of the biggest reasons is for us all to begin to be thinking about simpler, less consumptive lifestyles, and something that a problem that I see is getting worse and worse, and I think it's the issue of time pressure and overwork in our society today. I always like to remember that 10 years ago, and this may not be true for you, but it's definitely true for me, maybe it's where I work or where I live or whatever, it's obviously not true for people who live in Holden. But what I remember is that 10 years ago, if I used to say to somebody, hi, how are you? They'd say, fine, how are you? That kind of thing. Now everybody's response is say, how are you? They say, busy. And if they have time, sometimes they don't have time to say, and how are you? And people's appointment calendars are really, literally so filled up that for many people, you have to like look ahead a month or two to like have lunch together. I think it's kind of a scary thing. We really have an obsession with this in our society, and it's humorous, but I think it's also kind of tragic. But we took a look at this issue 7 years ago in a program on PBS called Running Out of Time, and it's where we sort of started the affluenza style of films. And but I think if anything, the problem has gotten worse since then. So
yeah, it's true.
The first clip I'm going to show you is from the film Running Out of Time. And we can, break things up for questions at any point. I'm going to show a bit of Running Out of Time, and then I'm going to show afterwards a part of the film Escape from Affluenza, which is the follow-up to the Affluenza program. And I'm going to show a few stories of people who have made efforts to simplify their lives and a little bit about what they do and what the results have been. Somebody can help me again with the lights, because they're on the other side of the room. But oh, and that one, a couple of these windows actually need to be.
What do you got? 10 seconds. I need to brush your shape on the bottle.
Hello. Oh, hi, John. I just don't have time to talk about that PBS series about time right now. I'm in the middle of preparing for my show. Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Out of home, Eastern Standard Time, 12 hours, 42 minutes, exactly.
Time family. The Harris Poll's at work time since 1973 is up 15%, while leisure time is down 37%. The first time ever, a majority of Americans say that they trade a day's pay for a day off work each week. Advertisers say that time is the luxury of the 1990s.
Can I help you?
Yeah, I'd like a spare moment, 2 hours to catch up, and 10 seconds to go.
Wouldn't it be nice nice if you could actually buy time.
Just give me a minute, would you?
Well, you can buy time. Extra working time with mobile phone service from U.S. West Center.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon. I think I can find a few minutes to talk about this. Do you remember a few years ago when scientists were working on all kinds of labor-saving gadgets said that we'd soon have more leisure time on our hands than we'd know what to do with?
The mechanical feeler does the trick. So does a radar antenna that steers a newly perfected, completely automatic lawnmower at Bridgewood, New Jersey. Smile. Why not? All she had to do was cut one strip around the outside of the lawn and then set the mower on automatic. From then on, there's nothing to do but drink her toast to a time saver that feels its way along. To make a long story short, Grass Spider makes short shrift of the lawn while you have a tall drink.
I don't know whatever became of Grass Spider, but most of us use many labor-saving devices each and every day. And in the end, what do they save us? Do you feel that you have more leisure time? Leisure time, do you have any?
Funny thing.
Zero, we're just discussing that.
Leisure time? Or the lack?
The lack thereof.
Leisure time what?
How do you use it? Do you have a lot of it?
Don't have any of it.
Do you find you have less leisure time than you used to?
Yeah, because I have to work harder for the buck.
I don't have too much leisure time, that's just about it, yeah.
Monsanto's House of the Future is open to the public at Disneyland.
It's an old promise to claim that technology would give us time, a golden age of leisure before the year 2000. American productivity has more than doubled since World War II, but the promised age of leisure seems farther away than ever. We got the technology, but we didn't get the time.
So it's kind of a cruel joke. In our society, we are obsessed with developing every kind of labor-saving, time-saving device to save time. And yet we feel we have less time than any culture in history.
Work up already!
What's happened? What's all this time pressure done to ourselves, to our families, and our communities? Are there alternatives to living this way, to running desperately in what many people consider to be a rat race until one day we simply drop? Stay with us to find out.
Run the machine for 8 hours. Your hands, your arms, just your whole body gets tired. Your eyes, your mind even. I am extremely tired right now.
Angela Waldron is a postal worker. She's divorced, the mother of two young children. Her shift starts at 6 a.m. and lasts for 8 hours, officially. But all too often, mandatory overtime can stretch that shift to 10 hours, with Christmas even 12. Then, her second shift begins. Now gets too little sleep. But in this family, it's 3 out of 3.
Like tonight, I probably won't be in bed until about 11. I'll be tired in the morning. The clock goes off about 3:30. I get up at 4, so I have 1 hour to get everybody ready and get everything done so we can make it out of the house at 5 o'clock. Say your blessing. And then if I couldn't get them in the bed the night before, when they're supposed to be in bed, which is 8 o'clock, and they're up past 9, then they don't want to get up in the morning. So then we argue all morning. And 10 years from now, I have somebody else ironing my clothes for me.
Undoubtedly, single working parents like Angela are the hardest pressed for time, that even two-parent families can feel the crunch.
Yes, thank you.
All of them?
Not sure. You noticed that even the prayer was a short one. Say your blessing, kid. And I don't know how many of you experience lives anything like this, but I think it's all too common in our society, and we're really paying for it with our health and many other things. And the issue is that we've made a choice, not consciously, I don't think, but we've made a choice as a society to take all those increases in productivity. And since World War II, for example, we've increased our productivity almost three times. That means that we could, at least two times anyway, that means that we could produce the same amount of stuff in half the time. And we were offered, in a sense, a choice as a culture, which prior to World War II, we always thought about, and in fact, which people always demanded, which was more free time, not just more things. But we really somehow, unconsciously, I think, made a decision to take all that productivity increase in the form of stuff over the last 60 years or so, and none of it in the form of time and leisure. In fact, we're working now than we ever were. In the 1920s and teens and 20s in this country, there was a movement among both labor and religious leaders to really reduce working hours. In fact, in the 1930s, there was a push to reduce working hours to 30 hours a week. And in 1933, the US Senate actually passed a bill. This was in April of 1933, that would have made 30 hours the official work week in the United States. Right at that time, almost 70 years ago, it failed the House of Representatives by 4 votes. That's how close we came. Now, 70 years later, with all of the increases in productivity, we haven't got there. But one of the arguments that religious leaders used in the 20s, there was a Catholic Monsignor who was a leader of this movement, who was called John Ryan, and he argued that working people and all of us really needed more time, more leisure time, in order to know God, in order to have the kind of quietness and space in our lives to be spiritually connected. But it's, I think, one of the things that we as a society need to try to find some way to solve. And there are certainly many, many people who are trying to find it as individuals, and who are doing that both to find more time, but also many of the other things that are missing from their lives in what's called the voluntary simplicity movement. And I want to show you some clips from the follow-up film to Affluenza. I'm going to show you first the introduction because it's sort of, I think, a little humorous, and we'll set this off in the right course. And then I'm going to actually show you some stories of people who are changing their lives and finding ways to scale back and scale down. And we'll tell you both how difficult it is to do, but also what some of the rewards are. First, I want to just show you the little introduction to this film, because this is, there's always those news stories that you really want to see, but you don't see. And so this was a news story that we've always wanted to see, but we didn't see, so we decided to create it ourselves.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
This is
Roberto De Niro with a shocking development to report. Those are the Joneses, the American family we've all been trying to keep up with for years. As you can see by the white flag, they are surrendering.
We've had it. We're exhausted. We never see each other anymore. And we have so much debt, it's just not worth it. So please, stop trying to keep up with us.
So what's next?
We're just going to try living better on less.
And there you have it, the Joneses surrender.
I'm Wanda Irving.
So I'm just sort of starting out here, and now show you a couple, probably three or four short looks at people who are taking steps to simplify their lives.
We're a giant. In the past 15 years, hundreds of Microsoft employees have become millionaires. Ron Simons might have become one too, but his life took a different turn.
I'm trying to watch my weight. I'm watching it getting more up. I know, this is where you need to eat these. Put your mouth around for this right here.
Ron is a regular volunteer at Seattle's Bailey Boucher House, a home for people with AIDS.
How do I get last night?
Not long ago, Ron had no time to volunteer for anything. He was a manager at Microsoft, a company where long working hours are almost a religion.
Well, I come here sometimes on Wednesdays as well as my Tuesdays to say hello. It was not uncommon to work 11 or 12 hours, 5 days a week, and then come in 5 or 6 hours, you know, on the weekend per day. So my life pretty much was Microsoft.
Financially, it was a very good life for a young man from inner city Detroit who was the first in his family to earn a college degree.
I went to Columbia, and to get to Columbia from the airport, you have to drive through Harlem. And you realize, you know, my God, my people are, you know, the drama that they're going through and the pain and the suffering that's going on. And then you arrive at this Ivy League campus, Ivy growing up the size of the walls, and you can get lulled into thinking, well, this is what, you know, life is all about. It's like being at this really prestigious institution and learning all these great things about business. But it's not.
As he climbed the corporate ladder, Simons grew tired of endless conversations about making money.
For a long time, I was thinking, there's something missing in my life.
He often thought about his grandparents in Detroit.
My grandmother in particular was one of the most philanthropic women that I had known in my life. I mean, not only did she give money to her church, but she volunteered and helped people through organizations that she got involved in, but also individually. My grandfather was all that in a bag of chips. He would give you the shirt off his back. And so that whole model was what I was used to.
And Ron had another dream. He always wanted to be an actor, but it took courage to leave the security of his career.
It was hard. It was sleepless nights and
Finally, offered yet another promotion, Simons resigned from the company instead. The first reaction he faced was fury.
My mother thought I was crazy when I told her that I was leaving Microsoft to become an actor. She said, you were doing what? Lord have mercy, Jesus.
Ron Simons has become an actor. It isn't easy. He's just beginning to do meaningful roles instead of commercials.
I like baseball.
But he's patient. He lives frugally, and he finds enormous satisfaction in the volunteer work he now has time for.
I really had an opportunity to feel that pain, to really get back, and man, I went out there. I mean, I just got involved in stuff. All right, nice save.
Besides volunteering at the Home for AIDS Patients, he reads to the blind, uses his business skills to help nonprofit organizations, and serves on several local boards. But he especially cherishes the time he spends as a big brother for a boy named Andrew.
We spend 4 to 5 hours a week together. He lives with his mom, and he's a big sports fan. And spending a couple hours throwing the ball around is good exercise for me. My being involved in the volunteer side of things has just been very, very fulfilling. We need to get out of this rat race and get a real life.
Not everyone chooses to downshift like Ron did. In the past decade, thousands of Americans were downsized, laid off when the companies they worked for cut labor costs to increase profits. Fred Brown was one of them.
I think if someone were to look at how I was living, they would say, He's really got everything going. Beautiful family, beautiful home, beautiful job.
But the beauty was superficial. Though Fred was earning six figures a year as a corporate personnel manager, his life wasn't as wonderful as it appeared.
The so-called good life was coming at, for me, a pretty significant price.
He worked long hours and found little time for his wife and two daughters. And his job was stressful. It was his responsibility to tell other employees they'd been laid off. Eventually, his marriage broke up. Then, his own job was downsized.
When I found out I was laid off, it was a shock to me. It's a different experience on the receiving end than on the giving end. The most difficult wasn't the financial letting go. It was the letting go of what I thought was what I was supposed to do with myself.
So at first, he looked unsuccessfully for new opportunities in his field. He could have found them in another part of the country, but he realized he hadn't been happy in his career.
There came a point where I knew I simply had to take the step off the cliff into the unknown.
Fred went back to school and studied massage therapy. His new line of work was far less lucrative than what he'd been used to.
I was faced with going from $100,000 down to $20,000 in income. And the question, obviously, is, well, how are you going to support a lifestyle, a $100,000 lifestyle on $20,000? And the answer is, you don't.
So Fred moved to an apartment, sold most of his possessions, and was forced to live on a whole lot less. Ironically, he's still paying off debts he ran up when he was earning five times as much.
But I'm not generating debt. I'm not spending more than I'm making. I'm finding I can make the ends meet. I have more opportunity to be present with my friend now. And it turns out that for me, living simply seems to be leading to more happiness. You know, wow, what a concept. I am thankful now that I was laid off because I'm doing something that I love. It's what the Buddhists like to call right livelihood. It feels to me like I have found my right livelihood.
Though his home is only a few blocks from the Seattle neighborhood that calls itself the center of the universe, Ming Chen and his family live humbly.
The Lord is good to us. Amen.
Their simple lifestyle is a result of a decision they made years ago when the company Ming worked for transferred him to a job designing weapons he was morally opposed to.
And I said, well, I'm not going to accept the transfer, so you can do with me what you will.
Like Fred Brown, Ming returned to school and changed careers. Now he works at a treatment center for alcohol and drug abusers. He puts in 3 10-hour days each week and is on call for emergencies. Ming's wife, Karen Schneider Chen, doesn't work for pay, but she keeps a busy schedule. Karen volunteers at a shelter for battered women and several other community organizations, including a food bank and the Baby Boutique, a thrift store providing clothes for children from low-income families.
It is important to us that we have time being involved in the community and time for neighbors and helping out older people in our neighborhood. I feel very energized by just about everything I do.
Daddy, why is the living room without?
With three children and only one paycheck, Ming and Karen have to be frugal.
We live in an old house and there's always work to be done to fix it up and preserve it.
This piano came from my grandparents' house because my mom played it when she was a girl. Now I play it. And then this chair over here, we had to reupholster it. It was a really ugly yellowish, brownish color. And I think it came from my mama's grandma. And then the couch, I think that came from my grandparents' house.
Ready?
On one of his days off, Ming and daughter Stephanie run errands. They buy used books, then return them to a local bookstore for credit toward other purchases. When Ming's toaster stopped working, he didn't discard it.
I actually was on the verge of going out and buying a new toaster oven. I had just assumed that anything electrical was going to cost more to repair than it would to buy a new one.
but at a local repair shop, he got the toaster fixed for a fraction of the price of a new one.
That was a choice that resulted in a conservation of resources and supported a small business in our community.
For Ming and his family, saving resources and supporting the community are more important than simply saving money.
A lot of the products that we buy actually don't save money.
For example, they buy organic food, recycled paper, and union-made goods.
It's a process of trying to figure out how to live your life in a way that's consistent with your values. Whenever we face making a decision about how to use our money or our time, we have to take those values into account.
Still, they do find ways to keep expenses down. They buy food in bulk at a local cooperative, reducing both cost and packaging. They cook from scratch instead of using more expensive processed foods. For much of the year, their garden provides fresh produce. They raise chickens in their backyard, feeding them kitchen scraps.
It reduces the bulk of our garbage and cuts our garbage bill besides, so we can get away with a micro can. And it generates fertilizer to enrich the soil in our garden without having to rely on chemical fertilizers.
We enjoy chickens because they kind of humanize the city, and people in the neighborhood really enjoy them. They kind of link us more to the community, and we get eggs, beautiful eggs, all different colors.
They also save money by driving as little as possible.
I realized that every gallon of gasoline emits 5.5 pounds of carbon dioxide, which is responsible for global warming. And I think it's really important for us to think of alternatives to the car.
Okay, so the next chapter is called Go to the Rail.
Most evenings, family members gather in the living room to spend time together. For Karen and daughter Susanna, it's often a time to make or repair clothes.
Just feels really important to come together after dinner and have kind of a smooth transition into bedtime. We've done that for so many years. It's part of our rhythm of our family life.
But like all families, this one has its conflicts. Daughter Emily, who's 15, is uncomfortable with her parents' passion for simple living.
I watch more TV, that's for sure. And I avoid the house a lot because it's boring. And I eat more junk food.
It's been difficult, but some of what's going on right now is the stuff that any child her age has to go through. All I can do is demonstrate my values. And I can only hope that will have an effect on her and the choices she makes.
We felt like, it really is important that we respect her wishes too.
As he commutes to work by bicycle, Ming Chen often rides through heavy traffic. That's something David Galvin doesn't have to worry about. Galvin found freedom in more ways than one when he, his wife, and two children moved from a 2,000 square foot home to an 800 square foot houseboat.
We're trying to live with four of us now in the 800 square feet, and it makes it nice and cozy. We had to get rid of a lot of clutter, and we just ended up with things that are really important to us down here, and that makes a big difference.
On most days, David has a commute that would make anyone envious. He can get to work almost as fast by kayak as by car without consuming energy or creating pollution.
And it's such a great way to get to work because I don't have to deal with traffic, of course. It changes the whole day for me. Gets me more in touch with the environment, which is what I do for my living too. I work on water quality and hazardous waste, things like that, so it's really important to me to feel that connection. The exercise helps too. It's a pretty good workout.
What are you learning through the practice of keeping track of your expenses just by writing them down?
It's the little things. I think I always knew that, but the extent to which that was true was kind of shocking.
A little latte or something every other day, mm-hmm. Before you know it. You look at it for a whole year, and that's a couple $100 worth of caffeine just gone down the drain.
At the office, Galvin finds kindred spirits who share his interest in scaling down. Several of them meet regularly at lunchtime for a study group based on a popular guide to frugality called Your Money or Your Life.
I've been struggling with my van. I spend $600 a month on that stupid thing to get to and from work.
Can't you use a car that gets great gas mileage that doesn't cost?
I bought it because I wanted to haul a lot of kids around and we go camping. But I don't haul kids around that much, and we go camping two or three times a year. I think I can figure something else out.
To follow the program, they must write down every expenditure.
I tend not to spend as much money. I always think, oh, I'm going to have to write this down, and so do I really want to spend it? And I find that really has helped.
Evie McDonald wrote the workbook that David Galvin and his colleagues have been using to simplify their lives. But the work she does today is a far cry from the career she once had in mind.
My goal in life was to become the youngest female hospice administrator in the country.
In 1980, Evie was well on the way to her goal. Promotions and pay raises were coming her way often, and so was a lavish lifestyle.
With each promotion, I was getting a new house, a larger car. I talked about wanting to help people who were less fortunate than myself. But I had 70 pairs of shoes and 100 blouses. I had so much more than I needed.
Then one day, she lost it all. In the morning, a doctor informed her that she had a fatal disease and only months to live.
The day that I was diagnosed with my illness, my home was also robbed. And practically everything was stolen.
Suddenly, both sick and possessionless, Evie McDonald was confronted with questions about the essence of her life.
Who did I want to be when I die? What did I want my life to have been about, to accomplish? And what I discovered was I didn't want to have the most things. What I wanted my life to be about was understanding love, understanding service, and feeling whole and complete.
Despite her grim prognosis, Evie recovered.
And on my road to health, I saw that I needed to integrate my life. I needed to become a whole person. And part of that was bringing my financial life, how I spent my money, what I did with it, into alignment with my values and my life purpose.
Shortly afterwards, she met a couple whose ideas moved her deeply. Joe Dominguez was a former stockbroker, Vicki Robin, a former actress. Believers in frugality and simple living, they taught others how to get out of debt, save money, and spend their life energy on improving the world.
What I felt was that their work was so important that I wanted to join forces with them.
For over 15 years, Evie has been working with Vicki and Joe, who died in 1997, to promote more frugal and sustainable lifestyles.
The nice thing about voluntary simplicity is that it looks so benign. We look so harmless. You know? Somebody said we're the Trojan horse of change. We'll just sneak right in and they won't notice it. They'll think all those sweet people gathering to talk about simplifying their lives. And then suddenly we'll burst out and transform everything.
Ask anyone in Seattle about simple living and they're likely to send you to this woman.
It's your big helping.
Cecile Andrews is the author of Circle of Simplicity, the story of the voluntary simplicity study circle movement she started.
I was a community college administrator for a long time, and I was always looking for some sort of class that would lure people out of their homes. And I had tried then a class on voluntary simplicity in 1989, and four people signed up, so we had to cancel. And then we did it again 3 years later for a variety of reasons. And that time we got 175.
Who's got the egg timer? You want to start?
Cecile organized small groups called study circles instead of lectures. Participants begin with a simple reading list, but much of the discussion is about their own personal experiences.
Dave and I have been making a concerted effort to get more connected in our neighborhood.
There's a sense in study circles that you're there to really change your life. The experience in itself changes you, and the reason it changes you is because people talk about their own stories, why they're here. They have no time, they're working too much, they have no fun, they're not laughing anymore.
What kind of you bring your baby to our home?
Group members pledge to make changes in their lives, receiving reinforcement and practical advice from the other participants.
I think the thing I would
would venture to commit to would be to get to know your new neighbors, to at least go say hello and let them know that if they need anything like tools or some way to wash their house or something, that they could certainly call on us.
Great.
I think I can stick my neck out that far.
Cecile Andrews believes support groups like this one make it easier for people to change their spending habits.
It's putting positive things in place of the negative things. It's saying the way I kind of fill up this emptiness is not by denying myself something, it's by figuring out what I really need, and I need community, I need creativity, I need some sort of passion in my life, I need a connection with nature. And so people help each other figure that out as well.
Thank you. So, just wanted to show these to kind of give you a taste of some of the different things and different ways that people do this. It's obviously not meant to be a how-to. There are plenty of books and other resources out there that work as how-tos. What we find television can do, and when I talk about producing television for social change, television really can't. It's a superficial medium, and the first thing we in television, who I think want to use it for something, have to admit is simply that it is a superficial medium. It is not a great medium for providing lots of information, how to, and all those kinds of things to people. But what it can do is, through storytelling and examples, inspire people to want to turn the TV off and go and join with other groups of people, or read things, do the other kinds of things that they need to do to change their lives and to get out and appreciate life more. The Voluntary Simplicity Study Circle movement, I think, is a rapidly growing movement. Cecile's book, Circle of Simplicity, which is the book about study circles, is a very good one to just find out how to do that. And there's an organization called Seeds of Simplicity, which Cecile is the co-chair of, that's based in California. And I'm sorry that I did not bring their number, and that I have suddenly lost it, but I can try to get that information. Anyway, it's Seeds of Simplicity, and I think the website is www.seedsofsimplicity.org. There's also for church groups, especially, I think a whole group of different kinds of materials that are available to start study circles and discussion groups and support groups in your own church community. And I mentioned after Affluenza that I think the best of that material comes from a group called Earth Ministry in Seattle, and has been written by a fellow named Michael Scott. It's S-C-H-U-T. Mike Scott's book is called Simple Living, Compassionate Life, and I know that that's available in the Holden bookstore. And he also had a whole workbook of exercises and things for churches and for groups. So that kind of material is available from Earth Ministry. It's excellent, and it adds the biblical dimension that you probably would not get, for example, in Cecile Andrews' materials. There's another organization called the Earth Institutes around the country, started as the Northwest Earth Institute in Portland, Oregon, that also has a whole voluntary simplicity discussion system, and there are all these sort of different ways. I think they're all excellent, and they people who are really serious about starting something might want to take a look at all of these things. So my suspicion is that for your church, is the one that Earth Ministry does will be the most effective. If you're not doing it through churches, then I tend to think that Cecile Andrews' much more open-ended the program that you saw here that she does is a very, very effective one, and that's contained in her Circle of Simplicity book. And then there are other organizations like the Global Action Plan, and they have groups called Eco Teams, which are really not so much about simple living as they are about living in an ecologically friendly and less wasteful way, however your standard of living might be. And they have a great program that people can use to get together with their neighbors or co-workers and figure out, at least whatever your lifestyle, how that can be done in a way that's less damaging to the planet. And it's an excellent program. Any questions about any of those?
Would these tapes be available to watch during the week? I mean, are they? Would that be a possibility? I would love to see the rest of them.
Of Escape. Well, my problem is I'm leaving tomorrow morning. Right. What I might do is, though, is just leave a copy. I have two copies of Escape, so I might just leave one here for Holden. And then if people want to, they can. There's a VCR and a small monitor, TV monitor in the Creekside room. Pardon?
Which one is Escape?
Escape from Affluenza is the sequel. The Affluenza is the one that starts out with the Joneses and that contains the section that you just saw. The first 10 minutes of Escape from Affluenza are really kind of about the problem. They're kind of for people who haven't seen Affluenza. We want to make it possible that they can see Escape and understand what Affluenza is. So they kind of get a quick look at Affluenza. I'd say the way to look at the two films is that about 80% of Affluenza is about the problem and only about 20% is about the solution. And it's vice versa with Escape from Affluenza, which admittedly has not been nearly as popular a program. You know, it's funny. I mean, this is something that I realized is that everyone kind of says that they want the kind of good news stories, the positive examples, and all those kind of things. That's what you hear all the time. That's what we people who make TV hear. But actually, we do find out that most people end up watching the bad news stuff. And that's what they tune into, and they respond more. So we've had far greater response to the bad news show, Affluenza. I think for a number of reasons. One, people can watch it, and they react in a couple of ways. It's a little bit distant, and they can sort of see it and see some of the things in there, like the four-car garage guy who's talking about you can never have enough garages and things like that. And they can sort of say, well, at least I'm not that bad. So there's sort of a little sense of, you don't feel guilty. But you do, I think about how can I maybe make my life, how can I change a little bit, move toward a simpler life. So it seems to have an effect. I've had people who've come and told me that, you know, as a result of seeing Affluenza, they made major decisions. They moved from bigger houses to smaller houses. I even had the writer, very famous writer, Terry Tempest Williams, tell me that very thing about herself, that after seeing the film, she and her husband decided they weren't going to stay in Salt Lake City in the big house they were in, and they were going to kind of follow their thing and go out and live in rural Utah, which they wanted to do in a much smaller place and so forth, and do work that they had always wanted to do out there, trying to bring ranchers and environmentalists and people together to solve some of these issues on the range. So that seems to work. On the other hand, one of the things we found with Escape from Affluenza is that when you show these stories of people who are like really doing it, it tends to make people feel guilty, and they think, well, I'm not like that, you know, geez. And so they sort of look for the thing, but they're so extreme, they'll say, or they're this, and we're saying, well, we're not, you don't have to be like the Chans. I mean, the film isn't like to just say that everybody needs to become like the Snyder Chans and really absolutely think about everything. It'd be nice if they did, but we hope that you'll just think about your situation and make whatever changes they can, because every little bit helps. But they'll usually pick the two kind of more extreme cases. One which you didn't see, the Dick Roy story. And they'll say, but you know, that's sort of so extreme. They're giving up so much. And can I do that? But you know, not everybody does that. It's a funny thing though. So I can tell you that this show has not been nearly as popular as the original. Never are. But. Any other? Yes, Michael.
In terms of television as media, you said that it's superficial and everything. And obviously what you produce shows on PBS. Is there any indication that network television or commercial television will ever pick up on issues like this? Or is it just simply cutting your own throat to air a series that would say, don't give in to consumerism?
You know, local commercial stations will occasionally do this kind of thing. I think networks are much more reluctant to do it because of the enormity of the kinds of advertising and things that they get. One of the things that was when the first affluenza program came out, it was reviewed in People magazine before the national broadcast. And People magazine was pretty good to it, you know. They gave it a B. They grade you grades, you know. So they gave it a B, which made us happy, because at least that was kind of like positive, you know. But what they did was, what was interesting was they started out the review by saying, well, this is the you always heard that old PBS adage, if not PBS, where? And this is the program that proves it, because there isn't a commercial network in America that would touch this thing with a 10-foot pole. And I'm afraid that that's too true. But shorter pieces, some of the stories about people taking steps to downsize and change their lives and stuff, those kind of stories I think have a good opportunity as short pieces to get on commercial television. The critique of consumerism in the affluenza show is much less likely to get there. But they can kind of, the other pieces they can sign up, well, that's just a personal choice, you know. And we don't want to say that this is all a personal choice. I mean, I also firmly believe that we need to do certain kinds of things as a society to make this a more simplicity-friendly society, to make it more possible for people to make these kinds of changes, because it's tough. And I think there are a lot of things that people can do if they're able to get their communities together. Some of the things that are happening in the Seattle area, which has been a sort of a voluntary simplicity hotbed, if any such thing exists anywhere, is things like tool sharing and other things where neighbors and get together and think about it. And they say, well, you know, we don't all have to have a mower, we don't all have to have this, we don't all have to have that. We can still have what we get out of these things. We can still be able to have the pleasure or the usefulness of these items, but we do it by sharing them so that we don't have to consume so many, and everyone doesn't have to have their own. I think all those steps are really positive. Anybody who's had their own experiences they'd love to tell everybody about? Yes?
I had a question kind of beyond consumerism. One scene that seemed missing from your film, and obviously it was too early, was the kingdom being imploded after 20 years of service. And you look at the waste that occurs like that. You know, another example was an Eagle hardware store that was built in Wenatchee. It's probably 5 years old. When the Lowe's executives came in, they were stuck at the railroad track for 20 minutes. And so now they're seriously looking at buying property in East Wenatchee to replace it. And that store probably won't fit anybody else's style. Will end up either becoming, you know, some kind of sort of secondhand mark, or be torn down. And you just wonder, you know, where did this kind of waste, and that's on a huge scale.
Yeah, well, I think those kind of things are happening. You're seeing, you know, we have, I think, as the original show Affluenza mentioned, that by 1987 we had more shopping malls than high schools. We now have twice as many now in the year 2000. We have 43,000 shopping malls and 21,000 high schools, so it's twice as much. I mean, it's grown a lot since 1987. But we also have something like 1,000 malls that go out of business every year and become vacant, like you're talking about, largely because many metropolitan areas and suburban areas are almost forced into kind of a competition to offer new and better tax breaks and deals to draw a mall from one town to the next town. So there are places where I was, for instance, in the Denver area, where this highway is the dividing line between one town and another town, and the one town now suddenly has a complete vacant shopping center area, and there's a new one right across the road because the other town gave this big special tax deal to get them to come in. I mean, it's pretty crazy, but it's really driven by where it's not. I mean, they like to also to say, well, they believe completely in the free market and all that stuff, but it's not just the free market that drives this. It's also that there are all kinds of tax breaks and policies and things like that encourage it, and it's clearly a serious problem. I'm currently at work on the book version of Affluenza, and which we're sort of expanding both the treatment ideas and expanding the symptoms. We now have a much sort of larger list of symptoms. And
now the book follows a movie instead of a movie.
Yeah, this is what usually like the book is written first and then they make a movie of the book. But in this case, I got a call from a New York literary agent who said, well, you really ought to turn this show of the population, turn it into a book. And
how about a comic book?
Mm-hmm. A comic book would be an idea. Somebody else will have to do that and then draw. But anyway, this will be, I think the book will be out next summer or something like that. And it will give a little somewhat more, I think, practical detail plus a lot of resources. I should mention that you could find a lot of resources, that is books, organizations, and things that will help you if you're interested in this particular issue by going to our website, which is www.pbs.org/affluenza, or you can do www.kcts, that's the TV station, .org/affluenza. And that is a website that's the site for both the Affluenza program and the Escape from Affluenza program. And we actually just got some sort of write-up in the USA Sunday supplement for papers. A friend of mine from Minneapolis found it in one of the papers and sent it to me, and they had a big write-up on the website and gave it all these stars and said everybody should see it if they were interested in simplifying their lives. So that's one place that you can get some of the books and the other organizations with their addresses and phone numbers that I've forgotten.
Are you going to be making that the copy you're going to donate? Is it possible? We're leaving tomorrow too, so I might be interested in seeing it either after Vespers or tomorrow morning.
Sure. Yeah, I'll make it available, and you can, you know, if you want, take it in there. I'm going to be showing a different film this evening at 8:30.
Right,
but if you're more interested in seeing Escape from Affluenza, you could just take a copy.
Into the next room.
Do it in the next room.
Yeah.
So I'll be happy to make that available.
And then whenever we're done there, I guess you can pick it up and
Yeah,
take
sure.
Where you want.
Sure. Yeah. So why don't you come in here at 8, right before 8:30, right before movie time, and I'll just, or I can give it to you now.
Yeah.
You know, either way. I think we're. I actually have to. Oh, go ahead.
Just, what's the movie tonight? A little bit about it.
The film tonight.
Yes.
It's called For Earth's Sake, The Life and Times of David Brower, and it's a biography of America's most famous environmentalist, and the person who was probably more responsible than anyone else for saving the wilderness of the North Cascades, but for doing many other things as well. And I'll say a little bit, I'm actually doing the homily tonight, so I'll say a little tiny bit about him, not about the film.
Right.
So I don't want to make a promotion here.
Okay.
Thank you all.